Blog Talk Radio.
Because that would only continue the oppression and exploitation of oppressed people in the United States, and specifically African people born and raised in the United States. Socialism is an integral part of building social justice on this planet. The condition of my people, my history, was very much connected with other oppressed people, and I began to see that they're the same foot that was on the necks of the Vietnamese people, that was on the necks of all oppressed people on the planet, was the same foot that was on my neck. And so I began to understand that imperialism has to go. It is a poison that is killing people.
Enough is enough.
Yeah.
And you are not coming to the people's defense. So if you want us to do better, then damn it, you do better. Do what you say. This country is supposed to be about the land of the free for all. It has not been free for black people, and we are tired.
One question, protect and serve who? To me it seems that they just quit to observe you, and then they have the nerve to come and disturb you, enforce a curfew, they physically hurt you. I heard the patience was a virtue, but how long we gonna disregard the fact is we all talk and practice this new age, trying to rebuke rage, or y'all gonna need some skin more tougher than Luke Cage. Trayvon, Terrence, they gone, perish. On up to George Floyd, see what your laws avoid. And now we gotta find some sort of order before the slaughter gets brought up with mortar reporter. Those who do the unthought of, this we gotta put a mandate on. You see my bullet wounds and try to put a band-aid on. As soon as one of us take a stand, they wrong, because you wanna keep us on your plantation. Come on.
Must be a better way.
Where they comfort ya,
the sheets are on,
and I don't see no comfort up. Now you may prepare for 2K, but they prepare for 3Ks. Order comes here later. I see you wants to fight for solidarity, and still in all I see a lot of y'all ain't hearing me. You know what? The fact is y'all kinda forgot to struggle like activists, all-timers. Learn to walk the walk on the path when it's narrow. Can't be crabs in the barrel, this is grabbing the apparel. We should demand order to correct the manslaughter for residents of Flint drinking tan water. And Puerto Rico, what they here for your people?
No.
Let's stay strong and try to keep a hand in it. Transcend it until the next pandemic. Let's go. You only got suspended. They all saying I'm hating and only race baiting. But we ain't gonna trust us until we get justice. Yeah. In the fight for peace, we gonna rise like heat. Hey, cause in the darkest hour, we still fight the power. Yo, you can't stop the cavalry from Malcolm and Mallory. We're gonna keep it 100. We ain't trying to run from it. Yo, think we're gonna stay distracted. Y'all got it backwards.
We are oppressed. We are exploited. We are downtrodden. We are denied not only civil rights, but even human rights. So the only way we're going to get some of this oppression and exploitation away from us or aside from us is come together against the common enemy.
Yo, turn this motherfucking shit up.
Never was an African American, blacker than black. I take it back to my origin. Same
and I did not end up here from bad karma or for b-ball, selling mad crack or rapping. Peter Tosh tried to tell us what happened. He was saying if you black, then you African. So they had to kill him and make him a villain, cause he was teaching the children. I feel him, Dunn was trying to drop us a real gem. That's why we bucking holes in the ceiling when we hearing I'm an African.
You have to go back to what young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food, but he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, we got a good house here, the house Negro said, yeah, we got a good house here. Whenever the master said we, he said we. That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, what's the matter, boss? We sick. We sick. He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, let's run away, let's escape, let's separate, that house Negro would look at you and say, man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this? That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today, because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, I'm the only Negro out here. I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school, you nothing but a house Negro. And if someone come to you right now and say, let's separate, you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. What you mean, separate? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa. That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa. On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field then there was Negroes in the house.
That's right.
The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog. The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were, guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are still gut eaters.
The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes, and he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority, and they hated the master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masses are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts, our Navy, that's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day used Tom, the house Negro, to keep the field Negroes in check, the same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Toms, 20th century Uncle Toms, to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful and nonviolent. That's Tom making you nonviolent. It's like when you go to the dentist and the man is going to take your tooth. You're going to fight him when he starts pulling. So they squirt some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine to make you think they're not doing anything to you. So you sit there and because you got all that Novocaine in your jaw, you suffer peacefully. Blood running all down your jaw. And you don't know what's happening because someone has taught you to suffer peacefully. The white man do the same thing to you in the street. When he gonna want to put knots on your head and take advantage of you and don't have to be afraid of you fighting back, to keep you from fighting back, he get these old religious Uncle Toms to teach you and me that just like Novocaine, suffer peacefully. Don't stop suffering, just suffer peacefully. As Reverend Cleve pointed out, let your blood flow in the streets. This is a shame. And you know he's a Christian preacher. If it's a shame to him, you know what it is to me. Because nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send them to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that old-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye. and a tooth for a tooth, and a head for a head, and a life for a life. That's a good religion. And then anybody, no one resents that kind of religion being taught but a wolf who intends to make you his meal. This is the way it is with the white man in America. He's a wolf, and you a sheep. Anytime a shepherd, a pastor, teach you and me not to run from the white man, and at the same time teachers don't fight the white man, he's a traitor to you and me. Don't lay down our life all by itself. No. Preserve your life. It's the best thing you got. And if you got to give it up, let it be even Stephen. The slave master took Tom and dressed him well and fed him well and even gave him a little education, a little education. Gave him a long coat and a top hat and made all the other slaves look up to him. Then he used Tom to control them. The same strategy that was used in those days is used today by the same white man. He take a Negro, so-called Negro, and make him prominent. Build him up. Publicize him. Make him a celebrity. And then he becomes a spokesman for Negroes and a Negro leader. I would like to just mention one thing else quickly, and that is the method that the white man uses, how the white man uses these big guns or Negro leaders against the black revolution. They are not a part of the black revolution. They're used against the black revolution. When Martin Luther King failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia, the civil rights struggle in America reached its low point. King became bankrupt almost as a leader. Plus, even financially, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was in financial trouble. Plus, it was in trouble, period, with the people when they failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia. Other Negro civil rights leaders of so-called national stature became fallen idols. As they became fallen idols, began to lose their prestige and influence, local Negro leaders began to stir up the masses. In Cambridge, Maryland, Gloria Richardson. In Danville, Virginia, and other parts of the country, local leaders began to stir up our people at the grassroots level. This was never done by these Negroes whom you recognize of national stature. They controlled you, but they never incited you or excited you. They controlled you. They contained you. They kept you on the plantation. As soon as King failed in Birmingham, Negroes took to the streets. King got out and went out to California to a big rally and raised about, I don't know how many thousands of dollars. Come to Detroit and had a march and raised some more thousands of dollars. And recall, right after that, Wilkins attacked King, accused King and the Corps of starting trouble everywhere and then making the NAACP get him out of jail and spend a lot of money, and then he accused King and Corps of raising all the money and not paying it back. This happened. I got it in documented evidence in the newspaper. Roy started attacking King, and King started attacking Roy, and Farmer started attacking both of them. And as these Negroes of national stature begin to attack each other, they begin to lose their control of the Negro masses. And Negroes was out there in the streets. They was talking about, we're going to march on Washington. By the way, and right at that time, Birmingham had exploded, and the Negroes in Birmingham, remember, they also exploded. They began to stab the crackers in the back and bust them upside the head. Yes, they did. That's when Kennedy sent in the troops down in Birmingham. So, and right after that, Kennedy got on the television and said, this is a moral issue. That's when he said he's going to put out a civil rights bill. And when he mentioned civil rights bill and the Southern crackers start talking about they were going to boycott it or filibuster it, then the Negroes start talking about what? We're going to march on Washington, march on the Senate, march on the White House, march on the Congress and tie it up, bring it to a halt. Don't let the government proceed. They even said they were going to go out to the airport and lay down on the runway and don't let no airplanes land. I'm telling you what they said. That was revolution. That was revolution. That was the black revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. Scared the white man to death. Scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there. When they found out that this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol, they called in Wilkins. They called in Randolph. They called in these national Negro leaders that you respect and told them, call it off. Kennedy said, look, y'all letting this thing go too far. And old Tom said, boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it. I'm telling you what they said. They said, I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it. They said, these Negroes are doing things on their own. They're running ahead of us. And that old shrewd fox, he said, well, if you all aren't in it, I'll put you in it. I'll put you at the head of it. I'll endorse it. I'll welcome it. I'll help it. I'll join it. A matter of hours went by. They had a meeting at the Carlisle Hotel in New York City. The Carlisle Hotel is owned by the Kennedy family. That's the hotel Kennedy spent the night at two nights ago. Belongs to his family. A philanthropic society headed by a white man named Stephen Currier called all the top civil rights leaders together at the Carlisle Hotel and told them that by you all fighting each other, you're destroying the civil rights movement. And since you're fighting over money from white liberals, let us set up what's known as the Council for United Civil Rights Leadership. Let's form this council, and all the civil rights organizations will belong to it, and we'll use it for fundraising purposes. Let me show you how tricky the white man is. And as soon as they got it formed, they elected Whitney Young as the chairman. And who you think became the co-chairman? Stephen Currier, the white man. A millionaire. Powell was talking about it down at the Cobo today. This is what he was talking about. Powell knows it happened. Randolph knows it happened. Wilkins knows it happened. King knows it happened. Every one of that so-called Big Six, they know what happened. Once they formed it, with the white man over it, he promised them and gave them $800,000 to split up between the Big Six and told them that after the march was over, they'd give them $700,000 more, $1.5 million, split up between leaders that you've been following, going to jail for, crying crocodile tears for. And they'd nothing but Frank James and Jesse James and what you call it, brothers. Soon as they got the setup organized, the white man made available to them top public relations experts. Opened the news media across the country at their disposal. And then they begin to project these Big Six as the leaders of the march. Originally, they weren't even in the march. You was talking this march talk on Hastings Street. Is Hastings Street still here? On Hastings Street. You was talking the march talk on Lenox Avenue. And down on, Fillmore Street. And Central Avenue. And 42nd Street and 63rd Street. That's where the march talk was being talked. But the white man put the Big Six ahead of it, made them the march. They became the march. They took it over. And the first move they made after they took it over, they invited Walter Reuther, a white man. They invited a priest, a rabbi, and an old white preacher. Yes, an old white preacher. The same white element that put Kennedy in power, labor, the Catholics, the Jews, and liberal Protestants. Same clique that put Kennedy in power joined the March on Washington. It's just like when you got some coffee that's too black, which means it's too strong. What you do? You integrate it with cream. You make it weak. If you pour too much cream in, you won't even know you ever had coffee. It used to be hot, it becomes cool. It used to be strong, it becomes weak. It used to wake you up, now it'll put you to sleep. This is what they did with the March on Washington. They joined it. They didn't integrate it, they infiltrated it. They joined it, became a part of it, took it over. And as they took it over, it lost its militancy. They ceased to be angry. They ceased to be hot. They ceased to be uncompromising. Why, it even ceased to be a march. It became a picnic, a circus. Nothing but a circus. With clowns and all. You had one right here in Detroit. I saw it on television. With clowns leading it. White clowns and black clowns. I know you don't like what I'm saying, but I'm going to tell you anyway. Because I can prove what I'm saying. If you think I'm telling you wrong, you bring me Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph and James Farmer and those other three.
This young lady right there.
I'd like to make a comment, Mr. Malcolm. Now,
Black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, People's Political Party National Chair, Matt Turner, co-host myself, Brother Motherland, National Minister of Defense, and our engineers on the ones and twos, Sister Amina, National Minister of Communication, calling each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time, at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, economy of the black ghetto. We're going to open up our phone lines to our chair. Black Power, Chairman, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Black power. Yeah, you're right, man.
Black power.
Power to the people. You know, right on. As you know, we continue to move forward, to continue to, make the effort to what we have come to realize, know, and understand as political education. Just certain of us who understand that we all have our own, certain way, but the goal and our objective is the same, and that's to elevate the consciousness of the black collective masses of people in this country who are still in a system that is constantly manipulating, exploiting, profiting in various ways, from consumerism, to the what they refer to as the prison system. This is a liberation struggle, civil rights can go no further than what it is, you know, in the area of civil law. Civil law hasn't been so civil to people of African descent, the descendants of the Africans who were brought here to this country by force and made to build this country's capitalist system, contrary to all the bullshit the intellectual mind shaping on the part of, you know, chosen scholars whose job it is to write the history of American capitalism, you know, and of course that is to mask, to dilute, if you will, the role of the black slave economy market, which is, you know, the foundation of this present capitalist system. You know, tonight's topic actually stems from this little book that I that I ran across recently. And, I mean, the title says it all. The full title is The Political Economy of the Black Ghetto, Why the Mass of Black Americans Has Been Forced to Accept Economic Deprivation in an Age of Prosperity, written by William K. Tabb, who at the time was at the University of Connecticut. And that book was published, 2 years ago. You know, and it's still relevant today, regardless of the age. You know, so this is what we want to show tonight. And it's a tragedy, in the sense that something that was being pointed out, drawn out through meticulous research, a careful study of the socio-political economic situation of the so-called ghetto, which, by the way, is actually a term that stems from Europe in the segment of the white minority world population, referred to as the Jewish, who lived in the ghetto or the ghettos of Europe. And so the transference even of the concept and the strategy or tactic was carried over to black people, so-called black people in America. Now it's mad, and it's rather ironic that there's been some like high profile like cases or just sort of picture or image that has been painted, stemming chiefly from New York City, where the expression slumlord had been, you know, popularized from that direction. There have been a movie or two. I think there have been a movie that was made by Spike Lee a long time ago. But the slumlord in Harlem or in Brooklyn or Queens, and this slumlord in some cases actually Jewish. The white Jew. And then, of course, this like reputation, so to speak, you know. I remember Flavor Flav in one of his songs where he has a rhyme. He's talking about, you know, like the hood or what have you, or something to the effect that, you know, I'm being rejected by talking to Mr. Stein because I ain't your kind. And so that was a subliminal, subtle reference to the white Jewish slumlord. You know, that's a point to it. And so just to tie that into this, this little book, I was going to read the back of it, you know, which pretty much kind of or like sets the stage, or, you know, like a synopsis, so to speak. But at the time, it was referred to as the most comprehensive study yet to appear on the economic aspects of the black ghetto. Its major thesis is that a colonial relationship now exists between the ghetto and the larger society. Present policies, far from alleviating the situation, do much to reinforce it. And this is still relevant today. You know? The purpose of trying to uplift the ghetto, you know, thing about equality, you know, making our black community the equals of whites, you know, we can live safely, you know, in our neighborhoods too, you know, but no such thing. It could never been the point in the first place. It was never meant for black people in the first place to have just the same type of, you know, communities, you know, that white people have, you know, and it can never be separated from the fact of the legacy of physical slavery. And of course, you know, there are people who might charge me with living in the past, you know, that shit was, over 200 years ago, you know. And so on. But the, you know, the proof is in the pudding. The reality is the continued residue of physical slavery. this is some excuse for why, you know, the hood looks the way it looks, or why it is the way it is today. No, people just don't fall out and drop out of the sky, you know, or just emerge from their mother's womb and want to end up hustling dope. You know, we can take the same formula and apply that to the Irish, you know, who for maybe 1,000 years, you know, they've been struggling with the Brits struggling with them in their what we can refer to as tribalism or factionalism, and the conditions as a result of the oppression that the Catholics, you know, were facing or had been put under by the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. In other words, a semi-internal religious war between the Protestants and the Catholics. Yeah. And of course, inside the word Protestant is the word protest. So the Protestants deplored the Catholics because the Catholics, you know, were all in with everything that the Pope said, including the Pope himself being, you know, on the throne with Jesus, you know. But it's the conditions which developed in Ireland as a result of the imperialism endeavors of the British, you know, as a result of it. So I bring that up in a sense to show that it may not necessarily be about race all the time, you know, historically. But we know that in this country, it has to be about race. It has to be about one particular group that has been detested from day one, that have been, you know, reviled from day one. And I've said before that when physical slavery was ended, we was pretty much like a surplus population that didn't have no material value. And this is what has led to the so-called ghetto. You know, the same policy that, you know, the slums of Europe, you know, which have been applied right here, you know, with no type of support system, you know, that would keep, you know, black people from veering off into vice that would be the end product of it. You know, it turns into a game of survival, and then it gets deeper. It gets more deadlier, because the only people that around you is the people that look like you, and so this vice naturally accumulate into violence, due to the fact that, you know, black people have been placed in the condition now which borders on survival of the fittest. And this is what you see today. Now, I want to mention this right quick. It's a paper that was written by a former Black Panther Party member who's known as Setawayo, Michael Tabor, or Tabor, T-A-B-O-R. It was a paper that he had written about, you know, crime plus dope or something, either genocide or something like that. And he placed, you know, what this book speaks about in a context from the viewpoint of a revolutionary, which therefore makes it practical to demolish the system, to dismantle the system and build one that belongs in the hands of those who have been the exploited. And of course, you know, there's a process to this, you know, learning these different branches of understanding, you know, like political economy, you know. Someone has to be the brainchild of some type of economic system that has a base in where we can use it, where it's communalism, social collectivism, we, you know, unity, the community, we one, that's one. And there's a African term that we know as Ubuntu, you know, Ubuntu. You know, this word can be, you know, kind of tricky to pronounce because of U in between the B and the N. It's sort of like two O's, you know, in pronunciation. And that's all over in what we play on is indigenous Africa, you know, meaning you can go in indigenous Africa and hear languages that we once spoke as the group that's here, which in itself is an indictment, you know, against this system that we now refer to as the state, the benefactors of the slave trade, coming out of the physical slave in the Reconstruction, Jim Crow. This attempt on the part of, you know, those who want us to believe are going to uplift or empower the black community now that it came out of slavery, physical slavery, you know, then relaunched again in Jim Crow, and then relaunched again in the 70s, in the 80s. And there are points in there, stages in there that we can look to that would give some type of idea of what it can be realistically, you know, prosperity, you know, jobs, you know, that we're told that, you know, the economic system, you know, that creates political economy, that creates jobs because this is the responsibility of the government and so forth. You know, but what happened there, you know, from 1970 to 2022, you see the same pattern, the same bullshit and jive. And so you have to draw a conclusion. To draw a conclusion after so many times, you know, I mean, if I kept showing up, you know, at the party, you know, with purple on, you know, every function, you know, wedding or what have you, even a funeral, you know, show up the Christmas badge, you know, every time you see me, I got purple on. You have to draw a conclusion at some point. You have to draw a conclusion that concludes. So that's, I obviously have some type of infatuation for purple, and there's a reason why I had this infatuation, because I had to develop it. It was something about the color purple that got me into it. You know, it may have been Prince album, Purple Rain, but something led me into it. Or the understanding that in Africa, purple is a color of royalty, but it was something that led me to it. Now, if you take that same, you know, the ghetto, the black neighborhood, and why from 1970 to 2022, you see this similar pattern which has gotten more sophisticated, as a matter of fact. It has gotten more deadly. And so you have to, at some point, begin to draw a conclusion that can include as to why this shit is like this, as to why it's still like this. You know, as to why, you know, black people just ain't able to get it together. So they need help. We need help. You know, so that means we got to turn to external forces to come in and rescue us. You know. And if we need help, then why do we need help is the question. Because the same external forces, through the use of the corporate controlled media, give the impression to the rest of the world that black people need help. The same forces that come in and try to save the day for us is the same forces that create the conditions as to why we need the help in the first place. And this is where it's at. This is what it boils down to. And that's why William Taft made the comments that he made. That's why he, you know, the few paragraphs, you know, to sum it up. And when you talk about, you know, what must be done and what need to be done and what has to be done and to build black people up, to uplift black people, and my favorite word, empower black people, you know. And yet, William Taft viewed the conclusion. The major thesis is that a colonial relationship exists between the ghetto and the large society. And so what does he mean by that, a colonial relationship? The same colonial relationship that existed in the aftermath of the so-called scramble for Africa around 1885. You know, where a group of rich white aristocrats from Europe got together I believe, Germany, the Berlin Conference, and got a map of what they thought was the geographical boundaries of Africa and began to carve it up for themselves and then force their way in and then create boundaries and jurisdictions. And institute and implement a colonial policy. And these colonial policies did what? You know, these colonial policies served them. And the money that they accumulated in their coffers went to Europe. It didn't go to Ghana. It didn't go to Guinea-Bissau. It didn't go to Zimbabwe. No, it didn't go to this fictitious boundary called the country of South Africa. You know, it didn't go there. It didn't go to the Congo. It was called the Belgian Congo after the country of Belgium in Europe. And their leader, emperor, ruler, or whatever you want to call him, Leopold, and the extraction of the labor chief in part, the rubber, and the accumulation of wealth. And it went to Belgium. It didn't go to the black population that was being exploited from the capitalist system. And it was never meant to be. And then they turn around and say, are we going to empower these poor people? Empower them to do what? And so you establish a colonial relationship with them. The colonizer projects onto what's called the colonized, and they take on the colonizer's mind. They take on the colonizer's mind. And so if they take on the colonizer's mind, then that means they are against themselves. They can never be for themselves. They have to be against themselves. And this is the reason why you see these conditions that still linger, that still able to manage to stick around. And it's a multi-layered thing. Shit, we might have to come back next week and finish. But it's a multi-layered, sophisticated form of, tricks of the trade type shit. And to keep the ghetto what it is, I want to bring up something about the Black Panther Party, in a minute, but just wanted to cover what Tab was talking about, colonial relationship, where the labor class ekes out the wealth of the owners of the means of production, which is the white ruling class, and that money is exported to white ruling class enclaves, and that is a colonial relationship. You say, okay, but shit, okay, shit, black people work, working class people. They get a paycheck. The man take the paycheck home and hand it to the wife. And the wife go out and make clothes and cook, go shop, for the children's clothes and whatnot, take care of, make sure the bills get paid. Those things, these traditional relationship, so to speak, and that in itself is turned into a weapon, to pit black women against black men, but the consumerism part, that there's nothing to build or to return as a residual effect into the so-called ghetto, because there's no structure. And white people pretend, they don't do crimes like the shit that was done in the Fifth Ward in Houston, or the shooting that took place in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, or the so-called gangland hit on the South Side of Chicago, Crip Blood, in South Central, you know what I'm saying, Compton and all these places that have been made famous, have been put on the map. And so that's the one end. That's the one end. So coming out of the 60s, these concessions that were handed out, like Malcolm X pointing out, and people have trouble with this shit, but it is what it is. It was what it was. And I guess certain people are supposed to get a pass to a historical approach of it. And I'm quite sure I wouldn't get a pass. And of course, more times than not, it would be because I declare myself an avowed revolutionary. Like Chairman Fred taught us, keep saying, And so, on the other end, get us to believe, or to coax us into thinking that, we've made great strides and segregation is over, it's in its grave, and so forth. So now, We can turn a new page and be equals. And we're going to help you come up to us. You'll be equals with us. You know, and if you peel back the layers, you see that it's no more than just the words that I'm saying. You know, as I said in the beginning, it could never be in the best interest of the white ruling class, more specifically the private sector, to change the conditions of black people and make black people their equals. Shit, there are poor whites who would raise hell. You know, working class whites, lumping proletarian whites, you know, who would throw a Molotov cocktail bottle in the flag. You know, if that had any validity to it. Now, for those who are listening, you want to get in, question, comment, view what have you, or in relation to what has been said thus far, dial, you know, number, press 1, and we'll make sure that you get on. No. And it's clear to me that there will be some type of opposing view. Not a problem. Not a problem at all. No. But in a from a realistic point of view, a realistic angle, no. When you talk about uplifting or empowering the ghetto, and for a ghetto to get up on a similar footing, you know, like, you know, nice white neighborhoods, you know, what type of quote unquote black neighborhood would this end up being? See, you know, we have to stop letting people just shoot that shit to us, you know, and just say, you know, we'll clean up the hood. We'll clean up the drugs, and turn the neighborhood around. Okay, we clean up the hood and the drugs and turn the neighborhood around into what? There has to be some type of structure that has to be put in place. Now, either we look at this shit through African eyes, or we look at it through somebody else's eyes. But if we're looking at it through African eyes, then we have to be out of our minds to think that, you know, these corporations, you know, Ford, or companies or what have you, Wall Street companies, Fortune 500 club companies, you know, Walmart, you know, the Walton family, you know, Chrysler, and so forth, you know, is going to somehow make a contribution that end up being something that is juxtaposed to them. You know, Chinese people, they have a Chinatown. You know, they have Chinatown. And it's because of China that they can have this Chinatown and operate in their own culture, you know, speak their own language, and so forth. You know, the states have turned in the favor of the Chinese world economic idea. And so they come with a backing. And what is that system? That system was based on the Chinese Communist Party, you know, via socialism that ends in communism, you know. And so the U.S. and their NATO buddies are having trouble with the shit, you know. And so you can go to China and see Chinese neighborhoods. and don't nobody dictate to them what it's going to be like. And somebody's going to come there and finance them and let them just give them the money. You know, the Europeans will never cough up $500 million and fix up no black neighborhood in America and not get something out of it. And that is why William Tabb, you know, goes on, you know, to talk about documented fact that existing programs have failed to reduce poverty. You know, and it's still relevant. You know, all we got to do is just, you know, check the news, turn on our news on our TVs, and watch the news. It all depends on where you at. 11 o'clock and 10 o'clock news, east, in the central parts of the country. You know, and see the results. You know, can it be done? Of course it can be done. You know, but realistically, you know, like I said, there's so much, you know, we might come back next week, but, you know, ain't gonna be in no rush, because there's so many things, you know, that I'd like to get out, you know. So what, how would this look, you know, this black neighborhood, you know, empowering black people to, you know, raise their living conditions in these various forms, in these various ways. Now, the one thing that was became the linchpin or the model to do this was developed chief in part by the Rockefellers. No, and this model, whether we want to accept it or not, or realize it or not, is a model modeled on capitalism. And so therefore they termed it black capitalism. And so this is William Tabb talks about, you know, but right before that, he speaks about why black people don't own economic resources in the ghetto. And we kind of touched on it when you talk about the economic resources accumulating wealth, so to speak, you know, because of the colonized mind. And so therefore it takes a massive re-educating of the black collective masses to understand that. See, you know, we be under this false impression, under this mythical impression that you know, some black person, you know, became successful and they put him on the front cover of Black Enterprise magazine and then put him in jet and then put him, you know, in Ebony Man or what have you, these other, you know, magazines, and present him as the symbol of progress in America. And should they doing that in Africa right now? You know, the rise of the middle class in Africa. And that is it borders on myth. You know, without looking at what they're really trying to get you to, well, without us looking at what they don't really want us to understand and see in it. You know, and so this system of black capitalism was coined. And the Rockefellers, you know, were behind it. And so what are they telling you right there? Mm-hmm. The ashes, what are they telling you right there? They're telling you that if this is going to take place, if this is going to happen, then this is the model. This is the standard model, and this is how it's got to be. And so we understand and know that capitalism is the fucking enemy. It's always been an enemy since day one. And you can ask poor white people what they think about it, you know, if you want to do that. And if the poor whites shows disdain and has disdain for it, then I can only imagine what black people should feel towards it. You know, and so it is the enemy, and it will continue to be the enemy until we fucking bring it to his knees, you know, through a massive struggle, you know, turning into a international struggle of black and brown people around the world and their allies, if there's going to be allies, you know. So if it cannot be by their auspices, by their design or their idea, then ain't going to be no successful black neighborhood of working class people. And let's get this working class shit straight. What they simply mean is, you know, black people who go out and toil every day on their feet, you know, producing, you know, doing labor. So therefore, you being handed a uniform working at the sewage and water board. And that uniform consists of a bluish shirt with a patch on it and some dark blue trousers, you know. And this is where this stigma comes from. So what they're saying is the mass of us who work our asses off and whose performance in terms of labor doesn't match the residual return. And this is the inherent contradiction, crisis of capitalism. But our people have not been made to understand that, because we're made to look at it from another angle without realizing that the labor that we sell or that we trade to the white ruling class is a labor of exploitation, you know, and a part of the white ruling class, who also take out stock and shares on the black collective labor, and they see no share in it. And this is what they refer to as shares in the company. But these shares is only meted out, handed out among them. No. And so this system is connected. This is what he mean by the colonial relationship, you know, between black people and the larger society. The larger society is simply, basically, you know, academic jargon for whites, you know, in general, you know. In order for this black empowerment to really have empowerment, then let us take the EM off the front of it, as though we don't understand and realize the rules that's being ran on us. When they say empowerment, we're empowered. And some people think that empowered and power is the same thing. And they are not. You know what I'm saying? They're not. They're not one and the same. So therefore, empowerment can always be used against black youth. because it wouldn't go no further than their doorstep. And so when we say power, the power to determine one's own destiny, the power to determine one's own direction or one's own path, such as what Marcus Garvey was talking about. And of course, that was a problem, you know. And so we're back again as to what model should be used and is feasible, not for a handful of us, but what's feasible for the collective. And so if it's that, then obviously it contradicts black capitalism. I've said it before, and I said again, that black capitalism, brown capitalism, red capitalism, yellow capitalism, white is understood capitalism, it just as dangerous one as it is the other. Economic resources. In order for that to transpire, then black capitalism would have to flip those dollars, and those dollars will have to circulate in the community and not leave. And of course, we may trade a few of those dollars outside of the community, but the overwhelming majority of those dollars circulates within the community. So what's preventing us from doing it? Why haven't we done it? No. We haven't done it because we haven't been properly educated from a standpoint of collectivity. That's why. And the merchant, the so-called entrepreneur, his understanding of the worldview, which is profit motive. And so therefore, if it's profit motive, his religion, then capitalism is his Bible. And so therefore, he seeks to mimic, he seeks to shadow, or he seeks to imitate the white entrepreneur, the white capitalist. Right? But the difference is that the white capitalist also owns the banking system, things into consideration. So in order for the black capitalist to be in line or in league with those who trade with him for so-called goods and services, then he becomes the exploiter. And when he becomes the exploiter, then he no longer can relate to the very people whom he exploits, because his geographical boundaries become antagonistic in a sense. White Jewish people don't make money and move over here, so to speak. White Jewish people make money and they stay. So when they stay, then those dollars can circulate. And only one or two of those dollars will be traded outside of the community. And so therefore, they're able to accumulate what Tab is referring to as economic resources. And so when you accumulate economic resources, then you can build a community that can sustain itself. We say, okay, well, we open up a bank. Well, who runs the bank? Is the bank non-aligned with the central banking system, or it is? And now some people say, okay, well, hold on, that you're going a bit too far there, or that's a bit much, and we're going to have to play some kind of way. We're going to have to participate, rub elbows with them some kind of way. Says who? says who. When you go to China and you see the currency, whose face is on the currency? You go to England, see the currency, whose face is on the currency? The old hag done kicked the fucking bucket. So if they have the ability to create currency and use that currency to trade, whose face should belong on the currency? Or are we to keep dealing in U.S. debt under the so-called greenback with those rapist white men on the face of the currency? So what kind of black political economy we talking about here? So, well, you know, we have to start somewhere. Fine, no problem. We can start somewhere. Start somewhere, we ain't going to stay there. You know, so we accumulate capital, then we expand out on our own. I mean, after all, it's supposed to be a political economy. You see, these are things that we can say sometimes rarely get discussed. If we could bet, it wouldn't be a bad bet. I'm not going to say that, you know, we're here tonight, and this is the first time in the history of black revolutionary theoretical views, or whatever you want to call it, that this has been discussed, that we're making history tonight. You know, we're not going to be that foolish. What we're doing is we're going into specifics in order that people can understand the same shit. So if this has to be done, then they know how to deal with these external forces who on one end keep our communities stagnant and on the other end come in and play the rescue. That is a Machiavellian tactic. Machiavelli taught the prince, who was contemporary with him at the time, the art of bullshit in order to be able to keep his subjects under control. This has been perfected in Greater Britain. Not only has it been perfected in Greater Britain, but the citizens of Greater Britain are the subjects of the crown. Which places them at a disadvantage. Historically has seen Greater Britain set on fire and the beheading of one or two of the kings. I believe it was King George who lost his head like John the Baptist. And so if this system is supposed to take place, that means it becomes a contradiction to what Rockefeller and them was trying to implement as black capitalism, which is the antithesis of social collectivism. In other words, these black capitalists would be forced to break bread with the rest of us. Him being the proprietor or having a monopoly on the slogan, buy black. And the buy black slogan only derived as a result of the ending of physical slavery. And so therefore the whites, who were feeling some kind of way, rebelled against the black merchant, who in the meantime hadn't had any idea of camaraderie with the black physical slave population, them off into their own class. And so they had to find a way to reinvent themselves or to keep perpetuating themselves as black merchants, no, as Negro merchants. So therefore, the buy black slogan was coined. And that may shock some of us, if not most of us or all of us. And so black capitalism is just as dangerous. but the black capitalists would have to be transformed into a collectivist, which means that he would have to put in his share of the labor. And if not, then give up a huge portion of the wealth that he has accumulated. And if not, then he will be the next target of overthrow. This is historical. And this is what will happen if this political economy and blackness is going to take place under the system of black capitalism. But if we did it collectively, then we'd be able to see the world through our own eyes. And not only will we be able to see the world through our own eyes, we'd be able to trade with the motherland. We'd be able to set a model of example for the motherland. Now, as always, when a black man, a brilliant black man, or a brilliant black woman, or the combination of a brilliant black man and brilliant black woman get together and figure these things out, therefore they become public enemy number one, for the simple fact that they have now educated the people and have raised people's conscious level to understand what it really is and what it really means to have a black political economy of the capitalist system of exploitation, which brings the liberation of black women into focus and into view. Therefore, much more healthier relationship, a much more healthy relationship with the children, who therefore can function properly. And so when they enter the school in the local community or the local school in the community, which is what the Black Panther Party was stressing, community control. And the Black Panther Party had proved these white private sector, white rich ruling class themes to be frauds, and which is what made them public enemy number one. Because they had understood the same things that I now understand today as a result of their understanding, so I can understand. And so being in community control of our neighborhoods, and of course the school curricula comes into view. Dead Prez, a revolutionary duo, the Stick Man and M1. In one of their songs, they speak about the education system. Fuck their schools if their schools can't teach us how to liberate ourselves. Fuck their schools if their schools can't teach us how to solve our internal problems. Until we learn our shit and see the world through our own eyes. And so to bring our boys up from an Afrocentric point of view, because that is the most realistic defense mechanism that we could ever have in this country. Because white Jewish people will not allow you to control the curricula where they put their children in schools. They will even have some influence on the schools where they, you know, are that minority. You know, so much so that these Prayers, which has turned into a whole Supreme Court constitutional thing about the right to pray and whatnot, and, you know,
That's what that's all about. But for a minority of people to be able to have that kind of influence, which means that a minority of people has that kind of power. And so we want the same kind of power that they have and that they can exercise. And this is what William Tabb was talking about, which makes him say such things, you know, considering the potential gains from black capitalism proposals, including plans for community-owned corporations and incentives to the private industry to locate in the ghetto. Now, the George Floyd era, George Floyd phenomenon brought out, flushed out a lot of reactionaries, a lot of the same reactionaries who, hadn't George Floyd been lynched, would have never had any relevance to begin with. And so they come out saying we, because they saw the same things that the white ruling class seen and the white middle class saw. The potential to topple this system. And so they come out talking about we, to do the same thing that Malcolm X was talking about back then as a result of the original March on Washington, where they had no say or no control. And so phone call was made for them to scramble and get in the front of it. And most of our people don't even understand that. They're not even aware of it. And so to put a face on it, lets it get out of hand. And this is because it is independent in thought, independent in ideology, even independent in psychology, a psychology steeped in blackness, which is why it was referred to as the Black Liberation Movement, in contradistinction to the Civil Rights Movement, which focused no more on getting concessions and the reward of the Negro bourgeoisie, which has been intact ever since William Tabb wrote that book and had it published in 1970. And so you see the same forces at play, and their job is to keep political economy of the ghetto what it is, while at the same time create a few havens among themselves. And when it's necessary to take the little few havens among themselves that they have and project it with the help of the white corporate control media to the rest of the world and say, look, there are affluent black communities in America, which proves that the idea that the founding fathers shared has now become a full-fledged reality. And again, without propaganda, the state is powerless, or the state's power wanes tremendously. And so we have to take those same affluent black community neighborhoods and place them in the proper context to the rest and say, if this community can thrive and how it got there, then this community here can rub off on the one over here in South Central.
And so we can all, or at least collectively, I'll set up an 8 out of 10 in the room, and the rest of us pitching together to help the other two whom it got away from. And they see such things as that as welfare. And this is what William Tabb also mentions about the welfare system. Now, his incentives about the private industry to locate in the ghetto. And this is the same thing that was attempted as a result of the death of George Floyd. There were one or two high-profile former hip-hop artists who had taken it upon themselves to use the same strategy. While on one end, on the other end, these same forces, these same Fortune 500 club members create the conditions that lead to what is supposed to be trying to be fixed by the same forces. And so we have to question that, and we have to look at that as pure foolishness, as purely scientific. I mean, as purely utopian. Now, anything utopian on the part of those who are under the rule of the white ruling class is good, because it doesn't threaten anything. As a matter of fact, the only thing it threatens is those who are supposed to be trying to come out from underneath the threat of the drugs, the guns, the violence, and so forth. In other words, Black scapegoat. Yeah, go ahead, comrade.
Got a call.
All right, right on. With the area code that they call them, comrade, and you know, call you know, give us your name and your question and your comment. Power, you on?
Go ahead, 336. Oh shit, they gone. As you are, Chip.
Oh, there. Okay. All right. Well, yeah. Like I'm saying. So, you know, what I was going to say is that the psychology, the psyche, you know, of the so-called nigger. You know, the nigger is the result of the nigger is the result of the aftermath of what was necessarily going to happen. In other words, the writing was already on the wall. It was already the beginning of the end. And so the nigger is the result of that. In other words, the nigger acts out what the Negro hates in himself. So when he sees the nigger, he hates the nigger more than he hates the master. Only if the nigger would act like him and be like him, you know, and leave out the whole equation as to how this nigger mentality came about. And this is the same thing that the state does. The state does the same thing in order to justify a presence of the police in the ghetto. You see? And so This is a local phenomenon that the same tactic and strategy has been done internationally in countries like Iraq, all over Africa, pretty much, Latin America, you know, historically, Afghanistan, Pakistan. You know, and that is the strategy of what they refer to as destabilization, to justify the presence of the military in Afghanistan, to justify the presence of the military in Colombia, to justify the presence of the local standing army
which is the first line of defense, called the police in the so-called ghetto, which contributes to the political economy of the ghetto. And that political economy is what? That political economy, in essence, is one of ulterior means of accumulating capital, which is referred to as illegal. That is how it works. And so for us to believe that the private sector is going to come and help lift us up is pure rubbish. You can take these corporations and place them in proper context and see not only here, but around the world. And certain corporations who had installed themselves after they had installed puppet leadership in these foreign countries, for what? To open up these foreign countries to the Western ideal, the so-called Western markets. And of course, that Western market is based chiefly on the dollar, to trade your currency up against mine. Well, my currency is set at 100 pennies. And my currency, 100 pennies, up against yours is 29. So for every 100 pennies you have to gain, you have to not only give me your 29, but then another 29 and another 29 and a half a 29 in order to equal mine. Now, who do you think is at a disadvantage? So if you keep doing it, then you do what? You drive that country into what? Destabilization. That's how it works. Oh, yeah. We're going to give you the business tonight, as all the rest of the nights. But just to give you an idea of how it works. And so, therefore, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, what have you, who claiming to be political adversaries, you know, Fox and CNN, they doing their little, you know, their little skits, you know, their little orchestrated, well-rehearsed, opposing political enemy things, you know, and you never see them skip a beat when it come to doing that. And so what do they do? Oh, there's a hit. There's a regime in Venezuela that's starving its people. The people have nothing to eat, you know. The shelves are empty. You know, the economy is broke. The banks are closed down. And it is chaos in the streets. And CNN, Fox, who appear to be political adversaries, will show you the same thing and say the same lines. And on a local level, you do it right here. On a local level. As a result, political economy in the black ghetto, if it's going to be a political economy, a black political economy, outside of the one that is prescribed, then this political economy will have been taken over by the niggas. And so therefore, if the niggas take over the political economy, then that jeopardizes everybody else. Turn around, it can be used as a political tool when it's voting time. On one end, on another end, you can talk about the prison industrial complex, which gets in on the act. The dope trade. How is it that these corporations, these companies, through these programs, through these through the corridor of philanthropy, can establish a black capitalist structure of success and not wipe out the dope trade and not eradicate the dope trade. The black entrepreneur and the dope trade, I mean, and the hustler, right? The black entrepreneur and the dope pusher are virtual enemies. One contradicts the other. So therefore, one will end up hating the other. One or two things have to happen. Either the entrepreneur is going to move out, close up shop, or they're going to eradicate the dope pushers. Now, which one you think this government is going to choose? Realistically. You know, a foolish person, a naive person, you know, and I'm very cautious and very careful about, throwing labels on the people, you know. But you know, those who go easily, you know, to be easily manipulated, in other words, you know, would believe so, but this is what we're going to do. Come back for part two next week because I'm just heating up. I'm just warming up. You know? It took me an hour, 2 hours, an hour and a half. So, you know, sometimes, you know, we have to laugh too, you know, have fun too, you know. Laugh is therapy. In this business, man, you know, it can get very stressful, and it can become even unhealthy due to the strain. These hardcore concrete conditions that affects us all. And so sometimes we have to laugh. You know, it's therapy, it's sort of balance, you know. It's some madness, black rage, you know, is in the air. You know, so we're going to come back next week, and I should remember where we left off at. I'll make a note of it. But this is our rant for the night. You know, this is our subject matter. You know, we hope that we were able to, you know, paint a picture enough realistically, you know, not just in the abstract, you know, the type of utopian type of thing, you know, empower the black community to this, that, and other. No, this abstract language, you know, there's no real intent, you know. And that's why they say empower, you know, because it has its own ring to it. You know, they're taking terms and they're placing their own monopolies on them. They're trying to rearrange the definitions of certain terminologies. You know, the word revolutionary, hijacking terms that have been used forcefully in revolutionary wars, revolutionary confrontations with the oppressed in the state or the exploited in the state or the proprietors who are the stakeholders and the stockholders of the machine, you know. And so on that note, you know, stay tuned for part two next week, same black time, same black show, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern. I'm your host, one of your hosts, National Chairman, Brother Nat Turner. And it's an honor to do this. It's my duty, you know, along with, you know, my co-host, Brother Motherland, National Minister of Defense, and our assault technician, Sister Amina Ushun, our National Minister of Communication. Man, we love that sister, dedicated, selfless person that, man, you know, was a vital part, you know, this organization and why it functions. So, and I know we say black power, all power to the people, and motherfucking your whole group.
Explain to you also your soul, your needs, your political desires and needs, because that is Huey's soul. When we first organized the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, he would say, Bobby, he says, we're going to draw up a basic platform, just basic, that black people can read. He says, we don't want to go real elaborate with all these essays and dissertations and all this stuff, because the brother gonna look at that and he can say, man, I ain't got time for that. I gotta go see what I can do for myself. It's just a basic platform that the mothers who struggle hard to raise us, that the fathers who worked hard, that the young brothers in school who come out of school semi-illiterate. You say we want freedom, we want power to determine the destiny of our black community. Full and